The orders of the court have been pronounced through the clerk and are posted outside and downstairs for your inspection. This morning there will be three matters submitted to the court on oral argument. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Charles M. Acker versus the Texas Water Commission from Travis County. The court has allotted 20 minutes of oral argument for each side and 5 minutes. Well, we've done that in all three cases. 20 minutes for each side and 5 minutes for rebuttal in all three of these matters. The second matter is Charles F. Walker and Mary Jeanette Walker and others versus the Honorable Ann Packer, judge in original mandamus proceeding. And the final matter is Don Dockstetter Motors, LTD versus Patel Enterprises Limited and others from Hidalgo County. Counsel in the second and third of these causes are not required to remain in the courtroom while earlier matters are being argued, but we ask that you remain nearby. All parties and their counsel are advised that these arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. Should you desire to listen to tapes of the arguments, you may make application with the clerk of our court. The court will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each oral argument, but we will complete the submission of all three causes before our noon break. Court is now ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in the matter of Acker versus Texas Water Commission.
May you please report, Mr. Bruce Bennett, Mr. Jeffrey Hart will present an argument for the petitioner, and Mr. Bennett will open.
May it please the court, this is an administrative appeal from the Texas Water Commission's denial of petitioner's application for a wastewater discharge permit. The merits of the denial are not at issue before this court today. The issue, and the sole issue as we see it before the court today, is whether in passing Section 17 of the Administrative Procedures Act, the legislature decided to impliedly repeal the Open Meetings Act in contested agency cases.
Are the merits being challenged in the trial court?
Yes, sir, Your Honor, they are. Because this the open meetings challenge would dispose of the case initially, it was not necessary for Judge Delano to go ahead and consider the rest of the points.
But
if there had not been a meeting that complied with the Open Meetings Act.
But if you should not prevail on that issue, then you have other issues in the trial court concerning the validity of the order on the merits.
That's correct, Your Honor. To give the court a brief factual background, Mr. Acker, the petitioner, owns and operates a mobile home park near Huntsville, Texas. He rents lots to tenants who bring in their mobile home trailer. He started the park around 1982. In 1985, the health department advised Mr. Acker that he should go to an organized sewer system. He had been using septic tanks and packaged sewer treatment plants. He needed to have an organized sewer system to better treat the sewage. Mr. Acker decided to apply to the Texas Water Commission for a wastewater discharge permit, and he did that in June of 1985. The city of Huntsville intervened and opposed the issuance of the permit. The city represented to the commission that they had a regional wastewater discharge system and that it would be economically feasible for Mr. Acker, instead of getting his own permit and operating his own system, to tie into the city. Now, the problem with that was it was not economically feasible for Mr. Acker to tie into the city because the city was attempting to make him satisfy two conditions. One, comply with their subdivision ordinance, even though Mr. Acker believed under state law he was not a subdivision, and also that he had to pave part of the county road that fronted his property. That made the cost of a tie-in go from about $100,000 to about $800,000. The hearings examiner at the Water Commission, after hearing the evidence, recommended the issuance of a water permit to Mr. Acker. On November 26, 1986, there was a public hearing in front of the Texas Water Commission. The city again showed up and opposed the issuance of the permit on this issue of the tie-in to the city. There were no discussions by the commissioners during this public hearing. The commissioners, after some argument had been made, took a break. Two of the commissioners, the Chairman Hopkins and Commissioner Roaming, then convened outside the public meeting room and deliberated.
Are you using the word convened loosely here? They went to the bathroom.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is that a convening of a meeting?
Under the Open Meetings Act, any time two commissioners deliberate, have a verbal exchange about an issue in a case before them, that is a deliberation, that is a meeting under the Open Meetings Act.
Well, that is a good question, whether or not the meeting, the back of the deliberations, or a meeting.
Yes.
Two issues.
There were two issues there.
Whether the conversation is deliberation, number two, whether there was a meeting.
Right. And under the clear terms of the Open Meetings Act, the conversation they had concerned the cost of tying in, Mr. Acker's cost to tie in to the city's system. That was called the regionalization issue in front of the commission. The commission thinks that it's, if you can tie into a regional system, that is preferable to having your own individual system. They were talking about the cost of that compliance.
Is there a fact issue in the summary judgment record about what they were talking about?
Your Honor, the affidavit that was filed for Mr. Acker is very clear and very positive about what was discussed. It was this issue. The water commissioners involved filed affidavits. They did not deny that a conversation occurred. They said, we cannot recall. They also said, we know about the Open Meetings Act, and we're very careful and strict not to violate it. It's highly improbable that it occurred, but they're not denying that it occurred. We took the position, and the trial court did too, that did not raise a fact issue, precluding the issuance of a summary judgment.
What was the length of the conversation?
I believe it was maybe a couple of minutes, as I recall. I don't know, Your Honor, if that is the length is set out in the affidavit.
This was in the midst of the hearing?
Yes, sir. We had not finished the arguments before the commission. They took a break, a recess.
And then after the conversation took place, they ended up voting opposite ways?
That's correct.
Does that make any difference?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. It's still a deliberation. They were attempting they were discussing the merits of the case. They were discussing the key issue in the case. That's what most of the argument was about. What was the true cost of connecting with the city? They come back from the restroom. We reconvened the hearing. One of the commissioners asked some questions about land use around the city of Huntsville. They then voted 2-1 to reject the hearing examiner's recommendation that Mr. Acker receive a permit and deny the permit. Then a week later, on December 6th, we got a written order, and the vote was now 3-0 to deny. There had been a change in the vote. We had one vote to grant. Now that vote was not there. Also in this written order, for the first time, the commissioners indicated they had a problem with the water quality, that is, the quality of the discharge from Mr. Acker's proposed plant. That was never alluded to by any of the questions before the commission. Now, we filed a motion for rehearing, raised this open meetings problem, plus the other problems we had with the order. That was denied. We filed suit in district court. We moved for summary judgment on the ground that the water commission had violated the Open Meetings Act. The Attorney General responded by saying the act was not violated. In their initial response, they said, well, this conversation did not rise to the level of a deliberation. Therefore, there was no meeting. Well, again, the problem with that is you did have a verbal exchange within the meaning of the act. And you did have an exchange concerning a matter of public business, the very issue, the crucial issue that was before them. Then they said, well, Mr. Acker wasn't adversely affected by this conversation. Well, I think the problem's obvious there. Then they filed a supplemental response, and then they said, well, no conversation occurred. Problem with that, the commissioners did not deny the conversation occurred. They said they just couldn't recall it. Judge Delano was the trial judge. He granted the summary judgment. He found that the Open Meetings Act had been violated in two instances, by the meeting that the commissioners held in the bathroom, which was a closed meeting, in violation of the Open Meetings Act without notice, and that the Open Meetings Act had been violated by another meeting, which obviously happened after the public session, when the vote changed and water quality became an issue in the case. He therefore invalidated the commission's order. The Attorney General appealed, and he argued on appeal in the Court of Appeals, that there was a fact issue on this existence of the conversation. And their second argument was, again, that this was not a deliberation. The Roaming Hopkins conversation did not rise to the level of a deliberation.
What summary judgment evidence do we have about the second meeting?
We have none, Your Honor, except the order itself. The order itself shows, and we also have the transcript of the public hearing of November 26th, which shows the vote. And then we have the written order, and you compare the two, and I think Judge Lana quite correctly considered that, well, obviously there had been another deliberation.
What if a commissioner wants to convene?
I believe you do, Your Honor, under the open meeting.
Say I change my vote?
Yes, sir. Under the Open Meetings Act, it says all votes must be held in public.
And this was not just a change of vote, though. There was another issue that was injected.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That did not come up any time during the public hearing.
Correct, Your Honor.
You said it hadn't come up.
It had come up in the argument. There were some arguments, I believe, made about water quality, but the commissioners, in their questions, remember, there were no verbal exchanges in the public meeting between the commissioners. The only verbal exchange we know about occurred in the restroom. The questions they asked did not relate to water quality, so there was no allusion to this water quality issue. Now, the Court of Appeals reversed. They did not reverse on any of the grounds argued or raised by the Attorney General. They reversed on Section 17 of the Administrative Procedures Act, which permits ex parte communication between agency members. They held that Section 17 was a later and more specific statute, and therefore it governed and superseded, in our opinion, the Open Meetings Act. Now, it's undisputed this is the first time this issue had been raised. The first point that we have in our application, which the court has indicated by granting that they would hear, you would want to hear argument on this, we think our brief handles this issue very well, is that the Court of Appeals erred by reversing on unpreserved, unassigned error. The AG abandoned all prior arguments and adopted the Court of Appeals theory, which was something the Court of Appeals came up with themselves. The Court of Appeals really came from no written argument, no oral argument by the Attorney General, but the source of this opinion is Judge Shannon's 1981 Baylor Law Review article. That's where you can find the underpinnings, the theoretical underpinnings of this case, under the Court of Appeals rule. The AG is saying in this court that, well, only the legal reasoning has changed. That's not true. A legal theory, a brand new legal theory, has been injected into this case by the Court of Appeals. It's not a change in legal reasoning. And we believe that under Clear Creek and Burke and your late decision a few weeks ago in the San Jacinto versus Duke case that this was improper. The Court of Appeals could not on its own inject a brand new legal theory into a summary judgment type case.
If we accepted your argument on that point, there would be no reason to reach the open meetings issue.
That's correct, Your Honor. That would dispose of the open meetings case.
With regard to that point, if the Attorney General had filed no response at all to the motion for summary judgment, Could the state have made the same arguments that they made in this case without having that problem?
Your Honor, I think the only argument the AG could have made was that our summary judgment proof was insufficient as a matter of law to show a violation of the terms of the Open Meeting Act. They are not disputing, I don't believe, that a violation of the Open Meetings Act occurred, the terms of the Open Meeting Act. They're saying that was violated, but it's excused. The violation is excused by Section 17 of the APA. I think that is almost in the nature of an affirmative defense, and I don't believe they could have raised this at all. And that's the point we're making in our brief, that that could not have been raised, even had they filed no response.
You think that a contention that the law is not violated has to be pled as an affirmative defense?
I believe the law, open meetings law, was violated. That's the distinction I'm drawing. The open meetings law was clearly violated. The Water Commission is an agency within the meaning of the Open Meetings Act. There was a deliberation within the meanings of the open Meetings Act. The Open Meetings Act was violated, Your Honor. What they're saying is that violation is excused because Section 17 has impliedly repealed the Open Meetings Act in agency-contested cases. Turning to the merits of the issue, it's our contention that the legislature did not intend to repeal the Open Meetings Act in agency-contested cases by enacting Section 17 of the APA. The Open Meetings Act was first enacted in 1967, it was amended in 1969, and again in 1973. As of 1986, the 1973 version was in effect. And here, again, there was a meeting under the terms of the Open Meeting Act, and there a final vote was taken, which was not taken in a public session as required by the Open Meetings Act. Now, the purpose of the Open Meetings Act, I believe this court knows, is to safeguard the people's right to observe the workings of their government. It opens the decision-making process to greater public accountability and scrutiny. It eliminates the secrecy surrounding these decisions, and it's based on the principle that the people ought to know and be able to observe the decisions of their public officials and the verbalization of their thought processes. But those should be heard.
But can that really extend to a two-minute conversation in the bathroom during a recess?
Well, Your Honor, yes, I believe it does.
Between commissioners who don't even agree on the outcome of the case?
Yes, sir, it does. That is the purpose, to let this exchange, the debate about the issues, be heard by the public and be heard by the interested parties. That conversation should have occurred in an open meeting. That's the only debate that was held in this case. And just by accident, we found out about it. You could have gone to that hearing, and you could have left, and you would never have known why that permit was denied. We had a PFD in our favor saying we should get the permit. The commissioners sit up there and don't say anything, just make motions, ask a few questions. That is violates the very purpose of the Open Meetings Act. Now, what does the APA do? It was passed in 1975. And it was to provide a minimum standards of uniform practice and procedure for state agencies in discharging its legislatively discharged duties. Section 17 is originally enacted, forbade ex parte communications between agency members and a party or his representative. It did not discuss the question of ex parte communication between agency members. It's our contention that the Open Meetings Act would have prevented that. In 1977, it was
amended. The rule that you are advocating here would impact on three-member commissions more severely than it would on five or seven members.
That's correct, Your Honor.
In other words, if the Water Commission had five members and two of them met in the bathroom during the recess, that wouldn't be a problem.
That's correct, Your Honor. Now, in passing the 1977 Act, it began as a Senate, it was Senate Bill 912. It began as a bill by Senator Brooks. It was to exempt the Board of Pardons and Parole from certain sections of the APA. It went into the House, and then in the House, Section 17 was rewritten and put in the language that is being relied upon by the Attorney General's office. It then came back to the Senate, and on the Senate floor, Senator Brooks described the bill as follows. He says, Senate Bill 912 makes some minor changes to the Administrative Procedure Act about public hearings on certain issues, and it specifically protects the Board of Pardons and Paroles when they have confidential hearings about parole revocation and that sort of thing. He says, it went through here unopposed. I don't think anyone has an objection to it. The House simply clarified one additional section that we hadn't clarified, and I see nothing at all wrong with it. It changed agency and person in their party when we used to say are his representative, and that seems all right to me. Then there was a question. Which bill is this? Senator Brooks says, it's 912, about Administrative Procedure Act. It's about pardons and parole, about confidential hearings on revocation. Now, I submit that that is no support for saying that there has been a drastic revision, which is what would have to happen if this court affirms the Court of Appeals in the open meetings law. That's correct, Your Honor. I did that just last week, and I will be happy to provide the tape and a transcription of that to the court, and I will do so. I did check for the House. There is no reported legislative history in the House. There was a formal hearing in front of the Senate, in front of the House committee, and it was just put on uncontested calendar in the House. Now,
the committee history and either.
I believe there's a committee report that's typed up that describes, you know, the bill as it was in the House.
About testimony taken on it.
If there was any, it's not on the tapes.
Any presented on the House?
No. In the Senate hearing when it began, was just on pardons and parole, so that would not be of any benefit. Now, the Court of Appeals said they were going to invoke the rules of construction and see which one controlled here. And they purported to harmonize this act, but they really didn't. They read out, and they impliedly repealed, the Open Meetings Act in agency-contested cases. They violated all the rules of construction. They said that they were supposed to harmonize it. And if they couldn't harmonize it, only then were they supposed to pick the specific over the general or the later enacted statute. These acts can be easily harmonized. The Open Meetings Act prohibits deliberation, that is, verbal exchanges involving a quorum of the agency members, and if there's no quorum involved, then the verbal deliberations among the agency members would be allowed. If you read the Open Meetings Act and the APA very closely, I believe Section 17 would probably permit written communications involving a quorum, but those writings under Section 13F would be made part of the agency record. But its verbal exchanges among a quorum of agency members would not stand. If there was no quorum, or if they were involved in written communications, those would be allowed by Section 17. And that interpretation corresponds with what the agencies have been doing for the last 12 and 13 years, and what the legislature has viewed this act as holding.
Now, so I'll understand, you say written communication would not be covered?
The way the act is defined, it defines the deliberation as a verbal exchange. The Section 17 talks about communication, which I believe could be written or oral. So, construing the two together, what the Open Meeting Act prohibits is a verbal exchange.
You mean that with respect to these two commissioners, if one of them had handed the other one a note in the bathroom, that would have been all right?
If you read it literally, that I'm saying that's possible.
Well, I mean, if you read it literally, an agency member might communicate ex parte or members of the agency.
That's what I'm saying. That's the word I'm saying, mean literally, is communication. Communication is not written communication. It's not verbal communication. It's just communication. But the point is to harmonize the two acts The Open Meetings Act would prohibit a verbal exchange between agency members if they constituted a quorum. That, if there is no quorum present, and there are a lot of boards in the state where that would not be a quorum involving two people, that ex parte communication would be allowed. Now, after the enactment of Section 17, Attorney General Hill issued an opinion where he found that there was nothing in the Administrative Procedures Act which overrode the Open Meetings Act in contested agency cases. The argument was made, and this is what, quoting from Judge Hill's opinion, this is opinion H-1269, you argue that the decision-making process under the APA is exempted from the requirements of the Open Meetings Act, and you urge us to reach the same result. We find no support for the proposition that the Administrative Procedure Act was in any way designed to permit state agencies to avoid the requirements of the Open Meetings Act. That was the Attorney General. And then, in this case, we also have an affidavit from the commissioners themselves who say they realize that the Open Meetings Act applied to them and to their deliberations, and they were careful not to engage with them. You also have had the legislature passing.
I believe your time's up.
Okay.
You have time for rebuttal. Are there any questions?
Yeah. No question. And Judge Hill answered them both in that, no, you have to do this in public session. So it also included deliberations. And if there are no more questions on that one.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Yes, please, the court. When the two courts are in argument from respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Linda Secord. I'm an assistant attorney general serving in the Environmental Protection Division. With me at counsel table this morning is the chief of my division, Nancy Lynch. I would like to begin by responding briefly to the argument of my opponent on the first issue, and I'd like to talk just a minute about the summary judgment record itself. In response, I believe, to Judge Heck's question, I have with me a copy of the affidavit of one of the commissioners, Mr. Romy. You will find that in the transcript from Travis County. It's attached to the response to summary judgment, the second response. First response to summary judgment filed by the AG's office, in which a fact question is raised, where Mr. Romy says, it's highly unlikely a conversation between myself and Chairman Hopkins could have occurred. He goes on to discuss he's aware of the Open Meetings Act and says, in closing, in addition, Chairman Hopkins and myself routinely do not engage in any conversations which are not necessary for the conduct of commission business. Our position was that raised a competing fact issue at trial that would defeat the motion for summary judgment. As to the second allegation about further allegedly secret meetings that might have occurred, the only thing in the record is the order itself. That the petitioner raised in front of Judge Delano suspicions about what the language of that order might mean and felt that it indicated that they must have been talking elsewhere. Again, both of those were contested below and brought up at the Court of Appeals level. And on that issue, let me point out that the issue of water quality, as the Court of Appeals notes in its opinion, was the subject of testimony before the hearings examiner. In addition, it was listed as the number one of the four major issues identified in the proposal for decision. It tracks right straight on through the administrative agency proceeding and shows up as the subject of findings of fact and the first few substantive conclusions of law. There are five conclusions of law, and the first two are jurisdictional in nature, but there are three that are substantive.
Is there anything in the record or the commission rules to describe the procedure the commission follows in arriving at findings and conclusions? Does one commissioner draft them? Does the staff draft them?
There's nothing with that level of specificity.
So we can't tell from this record whether one of the commissioners got the findings and conclusions from some other source and changed his mind and decided he was in favor of that, even though he might have voted differently at the open meeting. Or is there?
When you say got the findings and conclusions from some other source, you mean be outside the record and outside the party?
Well, no. One commissioner changed his vote between the open meeting and the final decision.
Well, our position is that he did not, and that is one of those unfortunate misunderstandings where you find out after the fact that you should have advised the state agency to write out how they do things. The practice, and this was raised before Judge Lund, the practice at the commission at that time was everybody signs the order, no matter how you voted, no matter how much in disagreement you still are.
Is that in the record or the rules? Or?
It's not in the rules at this time. It has still not been put in the rule as to exactly how they do that. The practice now, and this is, of course, beyond the record because it's changed as a result of this case, the practice now is that the chairman signs, but he signs no matter how he voted. So it is something that can cause confusion, but the position of the commission is that its vote is reflected, as required, its vote is reflected on the record of the open meeting. Let me also, in response to your question, Judge Heck, say that Mr. Roaming, if he changed his vote, changed from the minority to the majority. Our position is that he didn't, but he changed, as he did, from the minority to the majority. And so we do not have an alteration of the outcome, and we've got a harm issue below as well. And that was raised to Judge Lamana. I believe it was Judge Doggett who said they voted differently. That is in fact true. I mean, they came out of that other place and split their votes. Now, the legal argument before Judge Delano was that there was no violation of the Open Meetings Act because this fact situation, if it did indeed occur, did not fall within the ambit of the definitions of meeting or deliberation. Deliberation at that time was defined to require that they be attempting to arrive at a decision. And certainly, under this fact situation, there seems to have been no attempt made and certainly no success achieved. And when you look at the affidavit of Mr. Taylor, it is couched in general terms as his recollection of the essence of a conversation. But that conversation seems to have been a question that one person had about a number in the record and whether it covered one activity the applicant might be required to do or two activities. And they weren't sure. It's the kind of exchange that assists people performing this kind of function in understanding the record better. And for this mechanical analysis that quorum makes the Open Meetings Act more special, and it's okay that it hits at three-member commissions, it imposes a restriction that means that in many ways, especially given the changes in the definition of the statute in 1987, means they may only speak on social issues on three-member agencies, because deliberation has now been altered to where you're no longer required to be attempting to arrive at a decision, and an additional set of topics has been included for prohibited verbal exchanges. Now it's any matter...
Counsel, what was the length of time between the hearing and the signing of the affidavit? A week, a month?
I do not remember the date on Mr. Taylor's affidavit. It was...
a relatively short period of time.
I do not remember.
Because normally a person would have recall, wouldn't they? And highly unlikely. It's open...
Oh, I'm sorry, you're talking about my client's affidavit.
Yes.
I do have recollection of my client's affidavit.
Yes.
That was signed about 8 months later.
Okay.
After the appeal was filed, after the motion for a hearing period left and the appeal was filed and the motion for summary judgment was before the district court. So that was the hearing that at issue occurred on November 26th of 1986. The motion for summary judgment was filed and heard in July and August of 1987. So it's about 8 to 9 months. And so their recollection was, this isn't very likely, we don't do this.
Okay, well, that, the 8 month period would explain the use of the term highly unlikely.
But so I'll be sure about the second violation. Your position is that the fact that the dissenting commissioner signed the final decision of the commission is not an indication that he changed his vote, because that was the practice then, although that practice is not reflected in either the rules or the record in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
And
what is your response to the question, isn't it better not to discuss it outside of the meeting room?
My response is that the ability to ask questions of each other informally leads to better reasoning when you're charged with this kind of quasi-judicial function.
But couldn't you ask the same questions in the meeting?
Oh, you certainly could. Now, the Open Meetings Act does not require you to ask any questions at all. As it pointed out by the amicus curiae, Mr. McCullough, whose brief has been filed on the respondent's side of this issue, there is nothing in the Open Meetings Act that forces them to deliberate.
And there's no dispute in this case that there was absolutely no deliberation in public at all.
That's correct. They did not speak to each other as they sat on the dais.
If there was any deliberation, it was in secret.
If there was any deliberation.
Is there any summary judgment evidence that this restroom rendezvous did not occur? All I heard was, I can't recall, it might have happened or something like
that's
that.
That's right.
It just kind of... I'm not going to commit myself after they, but I can't remember.
That's right.
They did not. Summary judgment evidence.
But it was, in their view, extremely unlikely that it would have taken place.
That's kind of crawfishing, isn't it? It was extremely unlikely that it would have occurred.
Well, Judge Alana felt that it did not raise a fact issue on that question. We disagreed with him and took it to the Court of Appeals on that, as well as the other issue, which is that water quality certainly was not, there is no summary judgment proof that water quality or the signature line raised any issue of a secret meeting. The water quality is one of those issues they are required by statute to consider. It is part of the agency proceeding from the time the application is filed. That, in fact, is the job of the Texas Water Commission, is to protect the water quality of the state. And the statutory requirement is in Chapter 26.003 and 26.011 of the Water Code. And so it's the fact that they didn't have any questions about that isn't of any more import than the fact that this court may not have questions of us about a point that eventually turns out to be very important and the reason that the decision is made the way it is.
Do the rules or the record reflect whether it is customary for the commissioners to explain their decision or announce their decision at the conclusion of the hearing?
At the conclusion of the hearing, no.
So in this case, they might have just said thank you very much and gotten up and walked out.
You bet. They can come in, hear it, ask no questions, and leave. Now, there is a requirement, and it's a very important requirement, under AFTRA, Section 16, that they let you know if they have delegated the matter to a hearing examiner, they must produce a written order, and it must contain findings of fact and conclusions of law. They have to give the reason for the decision. Mr. Acker did not leave the Water Commission not knowing, or at least having the opportunity to know and understand, why his permit was denied. It was denied because of water quality, and it was denied because of regionalization. Regionalization is a policy matter. It is a goal that the legislature has instructed the commission to try to move toward, so that we don't have sewage and waste treatment on a patchwork, piecemeal basis. And that was, I understand Mr. Bennett's view that that was a hotly contested issue, but from the point of view of the commission, they're required to work on water quality. They are encouraged by the legislature to move toward regionalization, and you will find the regionalization conclusion falls last in the order itself.
Can you help me, since we didn't brief this law review article that the Court of Appeals used as the basis of their decision? Do you know of any other unsighted law review articles you might cite us to that help us?
No, I don't, Judge Smiley. I hope that you don't have one I didn't find from your question. I'm a little concerned.
I was wondering if you could help me out.
I don't have any law review articles, but one of the, I believe, amicus curiae on the petitioner's side cited a very interesting attorney general opinion. We know better probably than anybody. Those things don't bind the courts, but we sure hope you find them persuasive. And that's JM 645. There's been a lot of talk in the record about Judge Hill's opinion 1269. Well, that was a very short and general inquiry about AFTRA. A much more specific inquiry about AFTRA was made a decade or so later by the Public Utility Commission of this Attorney General. And the Opinions Committee looked at the question of contested case provisions of AFTRA and said that, and the background issue was the PUC gets a whole lot of informational technical stuff that there are privilege claims about, and you've got competing corporations and they don't want anybody else to see their documents. And the PUC said, what do we do about this? How open do we have to be? How public do we have to be? Do these become public records? Do we have to do it in public meetings? What's going to happen to the claim of privilege? We're concerned about this. The Attorney General Opinion Committee said that the contested case provisions of AFTRA provide an exception to the Open Meetings Act. The advice was, be as open as you practically can. If you can resolve the dilemma without resorting to an in-camera investigation of the privilege claim, do it. If you can't, you may review it in camera without complying with the Open Meetings Act.
Counsel, but doesn't a discussion, whether it's in the stall of a restroom, at a water fountain, or in an elevator where you ride down to another floor, create the impression of impropriety which undermines the public confidence?
Our position is that under these circumstances, no, it does not. That the conversation was very similar to a relatively routine quasi-judicial inquiry about the record. That I understand the concern about the choice of venue, perhaps, but in terms of the substance of the conversation, it shows that they're interested in finding out what's going on with these numbers. What do they mean? And the fact that they turn to each other to ask those questions is just part of what's contemplated in AFTRA in the contested case proceedings. I mean, our position on the substance of the merits of the Court of Appeals opinion, too, is that AFTRA's contested case provisions are the body of law that are to guide the agency's conduct when it performs a contested case function, which has been termed by the courts to be quasi-judicial. Now, I'm not here to say that they're courts, and the real courts have said over and over that they're not, but I think every court who's looked at the question has recognized that they do and they must perform a quasi-judicial function, and they are bound by those provisions of AFTRA. This is the one provision of AFTRA that lets them do something. When you look at the totality of all those contested case provisions, they're held to model themselves on the judiciary as best they can. They've got to provide notice. They've got to provide hearing. They've got to allow discovery and cross-examination and testimony under oath, a written order showing the reasoning behind the decision through findings of fact and conclusions of law. So that our position is that this is the one thing that they continue to do, and we get better decisions from them because of it than if they were hamstrung by having to never speak to each other.
If we approve that interpretation, won't we be encouraging agencies to do what this one did, and that is announce the result but have no discussion of how they got the result?
They are not required now to have that discussion, Judge Doggett, and many times do not.
But if they have it, they now, if your interpretation is incorrect, have to do it publicly.
Yes. True.
And you're not suggesting that by Attorney General Opinion 645 that the Public Utility Commission, for example, has been authorized to discuss privately all the rate requests out there, have
you? No, sir. The question before the Opinions Committee was the in-camera investigation of privileged documents.
You haven't touched on the points with regards to unassigned error, reversible unassigned error. You're conceding that. You handled that in the brief, and you haven't mentioned it here.
Oh, no, we're not conceding that at all, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals opinion is a logical extension of our legal argument contained in point of error 3 in our brief, which is this isn't a meeting, it isn't a deliberation. As a matter of law, the Open Meetings Act was not violated. What the Court of Appeals did was essentially make the right result, wrong reason conclusion. Y'all didn't take the analysis as far as we want to. We think you're correct. There was no deliberation. And furthermore, it's the kind of conversation that's contemplated as being appropriate in AFTRA. So that our position is that all the Court of Appeals did was develop our logic and reasoning. And in all of the briefing done by all of the parties, we have found no case on unassigned error in which the briefing under a point can destroy the point. And there's certainly no dispute, as far as I understand our contention, that the point was insufficient. The point said, as a matter of law, the Open Meetings Act wasn't violated. If we had written our brief to read exactly like the Court of Appeals opinion, it would have fit very nicely under the point of error. And our position is that that's all that's required by the briefing rule, that the appellate courts be alerted to the error and helped out as to why.
In the trial court, of course, vigorously contended there was a fact issue as to whether these statements existed or not, and that was your lead point, at least the lead point that you argued in the Court of Appeals. Are you still contending that?
Yes.
But you did not bring any cross point.
No, we did not. Now, the Attorney General's Office and the Water Commission are not here this morning to say that the Open Meetings Act isn't important. It is an important statute, and it's one that they intend to comply with. But it is our position that the contested case provisions under ACTRA provide a very rational and useful and workable exception to the Open Meetings Act. There's been a lot of discussion in the briefing about the canons of construction. Well, the primary canon of construction is to avoid an absurd result. And we ask that you allow the commission members to remain on speaking terms.
Any other questions? Thank you, Councilman.
May it please the court, to respond briefly on the water quality issue, all during the hearing before the hearing examiner, the evidence presented was there was a rule that we met on the discharge. All of a sudden, the final order came out, we were required to meet a higher standard than what the commission rules required. If that had come out in the commission hearing, we could have stood up and said, we can meet that. We'll change our application and concede we'll meet a higher standard. We never had that opportunity. How did water quality end up in the final order? Was it intuition by the hearing examiner? How did it show up? There had to be some type of discussion for it to show up.
Is there anything in the record which reflects, in Mr. Acker's affidavit or otherwise, which reflects that there was the discussion outside the meeting room was anything different from the discussion inside the meeting room?
Yes, sir. The transcript of the hearing shows there was no discussion whatsoever.
Well, but I mean, when the ruling was announced, one commissioner said why he was voting one way, and another commissioner said why he was voting another way, and then I take the vote was taken. Is that?
There was no discussion. One commissioner said, I move it be granted. No second. A motion was made to be denied. Second. That was the sum total of discussion.
How about the request for finding the fact and conclusion of law? Did not make that request?
Before the...
After the order was done.
We accepted those in our motion for rehearing. However, that's a very inadequate remedy to, on rehearing, try to undo a decision that's been made.
But we did find the basis of it. You can find out if you request the findings, the findings been made, you can at least glean from the findings the basis of the decision.
Well,
and you did not do that.
We don't think we found the true basis. The order that came out is just a rationalization of the decision. It's not a deliberation or the workings of the decision-making process, and that's the big distinction between the written order ex post facto versus decision-making process.
Did you contend that the fact that the final order contained grounds and findings in it that were not discussed at the hearing or in the application so far up to that point is an indication that there was some discussions outside of the hearing?
Yes, sir. That was our argument. And the reason was, how could it have occurred unless there was some type of communication somewhere?
It never surfaced at the hearing or in the briefs or papers, application.
The, in ours, Your Honor? Or
The new grounds that were found in the order.
Oh.
They were not discussed at all or briefed in the commission.
It was after the fact. Those grounds were not discussed by the commissioners at all. And our point is, if they had let us know they were concerned about it, we could have stood up right there and solved the problem. We were not given the opportunity, and that's the the evil of not having deliberations in public.
Is this new order raised to the collar, or can you come back with a higher standard?
Well, that's an interesting question. There's no race judicata in administrative hearings. There's some concept of race administracata, but there has to be some type of change of circumstances before.
We've been looking for that word for months.
But it's possible to come back if there are changed circumstances.
Is it possible, or would you characterize as deliberative? The following sequence. Somebody drafts findings and conclusions, sends them to one of the commissioners, he signs them, sends them to another one, he signs them, sends them to the third one, he signs them. Without discussion, without conference, is that process a deliberation if that's the way it happened?
Not under the Open Meetings Act, because there's no verbal exchange.
So your violation of your second violation presumes that it didn't happen that way, that there must have been some conversation about the findings and conclusions.
Well, the hearing examiner drafted the final order. How did she know to change it? Either there was a verbal exchange or there was some type of written instruction which had to show up in the record.
But
what
that could have been...
Excuse me,
what change are you talking about? Because if I understand it, the fact at the time was for the commissioner, whether they worked or not, all signed the order.
No, the process I'm talking about is how the final written order was prepared. The proposed order said water quality is no problem. How did the final order get changed to say water quality is a problem?
But if one, I don't know, the record I take does not reflect how that happened, but if one commissioner told the hearing examiner, change it, and the other two just signed it, and they never conversed about it, then that would not be violative of the...
Well, the statute. Conversation of Commissioner 1 to the hearing examiner, I think, would be.
Why is that? That's not a quorum.
Well, it's not a violation of the Open Meetings Act, but it's a violation of the APA because it was contact with a person who had involvement in the hearing process.
What if the hearing examiner just did this on her own?
That's possible. I don't think it's very likely.
You mentioned the record. If this was done all in writing and circulated, finding the fact from one commissioner to the next with a written memorandum explaining the thought processes of the commissioner and urging his colleagues or her colleagues to rule that way, that would all be subject to discovery. There would be a paper trail that you could get.
That's correct, Your Honor. There's also another very important point. Section 13 of the APA would require all of those written memoranda to be part of the hearing record.
So you can get all of the paper that might be shuffled among the various people, but if they talk in private, you have no way of knowing how they reach their decision.
Exactly, and I think that's why the Open Meetings Act focuses on verbal exchange.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Sure. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will take a brief recess.
I am the brief, right?